Welcome to our discussion on the death of science, question mark. And then joining me are two scientists, both of whom have been what you would call nowadays in 2022 cancelled. Chris Exley was professor at Keele University. Dr. Chris Exley looking into the effects of aluminium, both in our water supplies, in our general environment, in our food, and particularly interesting during the COVID business in vaccines. And Dr. Chris Busby has worked for something called the Low Level Radiation Campaign for many years, examining quite closely the evidence, and there is very strong evidence for leukemia clusters around nuclear power stations, which both the government regulators and the industry itself deny exist. Both of whom have been effectively cancelled from discussions and debate in our mainstream media, and to a large extent defunded. I don't think this has happened to you, Chris Exley, but Chris Busby even had a police raid on his home where they decided that his laboratory was in fact some sort of terrorist training outfit, which seemed absolutely absurd to anyone that knew Chris, but it suited the nuclear industry. Anyway, I wonder if we could start with you, Dr. Chris Exley, if you could just tell a little bit about your feelings on the matter of science and just how rigorous it is in 2022.
Sure. Well, I think one thing I hope we can all agree on is that science per se is not dead. It means science per se is something that is either unknown or is something that we're trying to reveal. And no, it itself cannot be corrupted per se. What we're talking about are the people that do science and the people that allow science to be done or not. So science, you know, I'm a massive believer in science. There are different ways of doing it. There are different methods, but I have always stuck to the principle that I am going to use the scientific method. I'm going to use the tools that are given to me by the establishment to get my message across. And as much as that has been a trial for most of the time, and I've had to work probably 10 times harder than perhaps others in different subject areas, it's always been my belief that, you know, science is good. So yeah, my perspective is much more from the point of view that, and you know, I can use a personal perspective almost immediately to say, why am I not doing science today? Well, I'm not doing science today because the funding partners, which is what my university called them, my ex-university called them, funding partners eventually told my vice chancellor to get rid of me by any means. Now, these are essentially anonymous people, organizations behind the scenes that dictate what universities do with respect to science, the science that they do and the science that is therefore reported from those universities. You know, I don't lump all universities into this category. I think, you know, Keele University is a small university, and if someone with a lot of money comes along and says, Keele, we're going to give you all this money and all this support, but you must do this, they will go along with it. I suspect that if the same organization went to Oxford or Cambridge, because of the huge endowments, et cetera, that they have, they would tell these individuals, well, we don't actually need your money. So I don't think that you can apply the same principles across the whole university system. And you know, therefore, there is a little bit of hope that somewhere there are places where research that is a little bit off centre can actually be carried out.
Chris Exley, you did talk there about your message, getting your message across. I mean, surely, you know, you shouldn't really have a message. As a scientist, you should be just simply looking at the evidence, doing experiments to prove what is happening out there in the world. And there shouldn't really be a message to as part of this. It should simply be experimentation, facts, and presenting those facts to the wider scientific community.
Yeah, didn't I say that? I mean, if you want to interpret it in a slightly different way, one chooses the area of research that one is doing. Although I often say that my area of research chose me. You know, as a very young, before my PhD, suddenly this area of looking at aluminium in the environment was thrust upon me as a possible project, which I did as an undergraduate project. From that moment onwards, I was hooked. You know, I'm a classical, in that respect, a classical academic, in that I had to answer this question. You know, and then through my academic career, I have had so many different people, high-standing, esteemed individuals, saying to me, well, you know, really, you should be looking at something else. You should be doing something else. But I didn't go into science, inverted commas, for that reason. I went into science to answer one question, and I spent my life doing it. So it chose me, and you're absolutely right. I hope that if one then goes through the 220-odd peer-reviewed publications that I've managed in this period of time, you will see that we have done exactly what you've said. We've simply done experiments based upon probably sometimes some quite outrageous hypotheses and other times quite simple things, and we have reported the results, positive, negative, neutral. And, you know, it's the area perhaps that we need to think about is also, it's not simply about whether or not you are able to do the science that you are interested in doing. It's then what can you then do if and when you get results that need to be published? Because you then come across a lot of other barriers. You know, the barriers to publishing absolutely perfect science are huge if you are not doing the science that the publishing houses want to publish.
Well, that is worrying, isn't it? The idea that the publishers are starting to dictate this as well. Anyway, Dr. Chris Busby, what's your experience been, and what's your thoughts about the extent to which science is, you know, doing what it should be doing in the modern world?
In 1994, when I wrote my book Wings of Death, that was funded by the Joseph Brantley Charitable Trust, they were interested in funding it because I said to them at that point, science is dead. So I kind of believe that science is dead. So I'm going along with that. But of course, you know, natural philosophy is not dead, and amateurs still look at experimental results, or they look at what you might call facts, you know, and they try to interpret them in some way, in order to come to some conclusion. And then if that conclusion is important and interesting, they try to publish it. Well, I've been thrown out of four universities, no, five, because the work that I was doing resulted in conclusions that were upsetting very powerful people, in my case, mainly the nuclear industry and the military. And so I had to find another way of getting my science across, or at least my conclusions, my research across. I have not particularly been affected in the way that Exley has, because basically I've been a loner, and I've done my science, if you like to call it that, my investigations on my own. And if I need to do a laboratory work, I either steal somebody's laboratory or else I create my own laboratory and I look to see what I can find. The big problem is this, that the state chooses the science that it likes on the basis of the direction it wishes to go, which is nearly always a direction associated with economic utilities. That's the problem. And so what Exley says you can't get published in the peer review literature, actually, with the new peer review literature as a result of the infestation of the internet in the last 15 years by Chinese journals, you can get an awful lot of stuff published in the peer review literature, in the Chinese, if you like, the Chinese journal peer review literature. And this stuff, if it's good, will be picked up. I mean, for example, recently I wrote about 2-3 years ago, I looked at the effects of fracking in Pennsylvania. And I looked at the infant mortality rate in the fracked counties compared to the non-fracked counties of Pennsylvania, and found that there was a remarkably highly statistically significant increase in dead babies in those states, those parts of Pennsylvania where the fracking was, compared to the ones where there was no fracking. And that got published in the Chinese literature. You have to pay them some money, about 500 quid. They publish it. It goes to peer review. And then, and that's been now picked up, and it's all over the place. So you can get through this sort of glass ceiling. My concern with science is the one I said, is that the state decides to choose what science it likes. So it says, I don't know much about science, but I know what I like. You know, and that's what they do. So if they don't like something, they will pick up research carried out by tame scientists. And there are plenty of those people who are paid for, university departments that are bought and sold, that do studies that are tendentious, you know, that in often cases they're actually dishonest, but they get through the referee system, the peer review system. So, because all of their mates are peer reviewers, and they believe they stick to the party line. So they're really two sciences. There's the sort of independent real science, and there's the dishonest science. And I can tell you there's an awful lot of dishonest science. I'm a reviewer for 3 or 4 major journals. And the sort of stuff they get sent me to review, some of these things are just completely bad. They're worthless, and in some cases they're dishonest. The statistics that are used are completely dishonest, particularly statistical studies of like you were saying about childhood leukemia after Chernobyl. There are some horrifying statistical studies of childhood leukemia after Chernobyl that are published by very, very senior and rich and, you know, professorial and funded people in the European Union, the International Union Against Cancer, the IARC, and so forth. So science is dead. It's dead because of dishonesty and cowardice. That's my take on it. And anybody who tries to get in there with something that's true gets kicked out in some way or another. But there's always a way in, and you have to keep fighting. And that's what I do.
Well, that's good to hear. Even if it is got to go through, you know, you've got to pay through the nose. I mean, I thought publishers paid you as scientists and us as journalists in order to have the right and the privilege to use stuff that we had written and the work that we had done. And it just seems incredible that sort of thing is happening the other way
around. Tony, it used to be the case that you would publish in a journal and that everybody in the university would buy this journal. So that's how they made their money. But then it became such that people had to pay page charges to help them out, so they had enough money to keep the journal going. And then that sort of morphed into a system where you pay for them to make it open access. So in other words, people can see it on the internet, but you have to pay them. And I can tell you, it's not a small amount of money. I mean, recently I published a very important paper about Hiroshima in a journal called Cancer Investigations, which is quite a posh journal, and it's all over the internet now. It's gone viral. But to allow it to be read by anybody, I had to pay £2,400. Okay, but I didn't, of course, need to do that because I left it to them. In this case, in those sorts of journals, you can do either or. So you can pay them to have it open access, or you can say, "Well, no, forget it," and then people have to pay to view it. So what happens is, if they want to read my paper, they go to the journal and they have to give them 35 quid just to look at my paper.
Well, that is incredible. Anyway, one of the problems quite clearly is that there has emerged, rather than the old-fashioned system, at least what we were taught was supposed to work here in the West, where you've got universities effectively competing with each other in order to bring in some of the most innovative, fascinating scientists to challenge orthodoxy. We've now got a sort of orthodoxy which is paid for, often not by just through government funding, but through private individuals, foundations like the Carnegie Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the more recently the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who are the richest in the world, supposedly funding whole university departments, including massive new building projects to build new departments at universities and this sort of thing. most obviously at John Hopkins University and at Imperial College. This is something which has obviously paid dividends for them during the COVID. But I'd like to just have a listen now to a chap called Norman Dodd. This is a recording made in the late 60s and early 70s over in the United States, where he explains that his congressional committee investigated a specific program by the Rockefeller Foundation and other foundations in the United States that were challenged by independent scientists. And so they decided to set up nationwide what they called stables of academics, including scientists, to give them the conclusions that they wanted and to actually create an illusion of a consensus around the topic so that they could get their way as a foundation. So we'll have a listen to that now, and then we'll be back to Drs. Chris Exley and Chris Busby.
We are now at the year 1908, which was the year that the Carnegie began operations. And in that year, the trustees, meeting for the first time, raise a specific question, which they discuss throughout the balance of the year in a very learned fashion. And the question is there any means known more effective than war, assuming you wish to alter the life of an entire people? And they conclude that no more effective means than war to that end is known to humanity. So then in 1909 they raise the second question and discuss it, namely, how do we involve the United States in a war? Well, I doubt at that time if there was any subject more removed from the thinking of most of the people of this country than its involvement in a war. There were intermittent shows in the Balkans, but I doubt very much if many people even knew where the Balkans was. Then finally, they answer that question as follows. We must control the State Department. And then that very naturally raises the question of how do we do that? And they answer it by saying, we must take over and control the diplomatic machinery of this country. And finally, they resolve to aim at that as an objective. Then time passes, and we are eventually in a war, which would have been World War I. And at that time, they record on their minutes a shocking report in which they dispatched to President Wilson a telegram cautioning him to see that the war does not end too quickly. And finally, of course, we are, the war is over. At that time, their interest shifts over to preventing what they call a reversion of life in the United States to what it was prior to 1914 when World War I broke out. And they arrive at that point, they come to the conclusion that to prevent a reversion, we must control education in the United States. And they realize that that's a pretty big task. So it's to them, it is too big for them alone, so they approach the Rockefeller Foundation with the suggestion that that portion of education which is could be considered domestic be handled by the Rockefeller Foundation, and that portion which is international should be handled by the endowment. And they then decide that the key to the success of these two operations lay in an alteration of the teaching of American history. So they approach four of the then most prominent teachers of American history in the country, people like Charles and Mary Byrd, and their suggestion to them is, will they alter the manner in which they present this subject, and they get turned down flat. So they then decide that it is necessary for them to do, as they say, build our own stable of historians. And then they approach the Guggenheim Foundation, which specializes in fellowships, and say, when we find young men in the process of studying for doctorates in the field of American history, and we feel that they are the right caliber, will you grant them fellowships on our say-so? And the answer is yes. So under that condition, eventually they assemble 20. And they take this 20 potential teachers of American history to London, and there they're briefed into what is expected of them when, as, and if they secure appointments in keeping with the doctorates they will have earned. And that group of 20 historians ultimately becomes the nucleus of the American Historical Association. And then toward the end of the 1920s, the endowment grants to the American Historical Association $400,000 for a study.
So that was Norman Dodd. He's a recording made in the late 60s and early 70s about the idea of foundations taking over from independent universities in deciding what does and does not get funded and creating these stables of academics to create an illusion of a consensus around a topic, which seems like a massive project to be doing after the Second World War. I just wonder if we could start with you, Chris Exley, and if you could just take us through any specific episode you want to talk about, or project or research project that taught you how things really work, where you found yourself coming up against, I suppose, in your case with your aluminium research, the aluminium lobby head on.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, one thing we have to be careful about is that there is true philanthropy out there. And by true philanthropy, I mean funding with no strings. And I would have had to finish my research 10 years ago without that. So not all foundations and not all philanthropic services dictate the research that you wish to do. Of course, what does happen, and I can give you an example of that, a personal example of that, is where your university begins by welcoming this money, because it's, you know, in my case, it was well over $1 million in the last 10 years, probably closer to $2 million in the last 10 years. And what small university is going to turn down research funding of that sort, which has no ties? It's simply given over as a gift, essentially. And indeed, the universities are able to claim a certain amount of taxes on it, etc. So in my case, for essentially 9 years, my university accepted this type of funding without any questions asked whatsoever. And in that time, you know, we actually did some of our, what I would say is our most important work, and published some of our most important work. So it was tremendously successful for us. And clearly what happened somewhere high, you know, within Keele's senior management is they realized this was an issue, that they could not stop my research while still accepting this funding from these organizations. And they made the decision that I personally would not be allowed to accept any charitable funding or funding from philanthropic services at all. So in the first instance, when they started the process of removing me, I would not have been able to get funding from the Wellcome Trust, from the Royal Society, from any charitable organization. And they did this specifically to stop me getting the funding I was getting through philanthropic services, primarily based in the US. So it becomes a sort of, you know, there are ways. If you are a strong enough person, as I have always been, if you believe strongly enough in what it is that you're doing, and if you always put yourself above the parapet and you're always being tested by the system, then you can get funding. And I could still get that funding today, and I could still be in my lab today with my team continuing our research through this type of funding. No, it's not Rockefeller, etc. It's not huge amounts of money. But for a small group like myself, if I needed about £200,000 a year to keep my group going, and that I always managed. It doesn't allow you to do huge projects, but it allows you to continue. And these sorts of small organizations are out there. They're out there today. And I would say they are proliferating, because they are not stupid either. They see what is happening. They see what you're calling the death of science. And they are trying to do something about that through their own efforts. So it's not, you know, we're not in a fait accompli situation here. There are places out there where people who are determined enough, you know, I spent many air miles going over to the US talking to people to generate this funding. It was much more difficult to some respect than the time I would have to spend applying to the research councils or you and other, you know, UK government funding possibilities. But I knew I could get that funding. Whereas if I spent the same amount of time applying to the UK research councils, I would not get the funding. So it was worthwhile.
Okay, but how do you pin that down to the aluminium lobby? And what is the, you know, the people that are opposing you effectively?
Yeah. Well, it's quite simple. I mean, again, when I first started to apply for research grants from the UK government through the research councils, which was in the late 80s, I was essentially being judged by my peers only. You then start to see the appearance on panels that are being created by the research councils in order to judge you of industry. And industry start to make a larger and larger numbers, disproportionate number of industry funded or industry based people in these panels. And so in the world of funding for aluminium through the UK government, I still managed to bring in about £5 million. But that stopped about 7 or 8 years ago. And it stopped simply because the opposition to my research within the panels set up by the government to peer review it was so great, there was never any chance of it being successful. So the aluminium industry is pervasive, it's everywhere, and its people are everywhere. And they don't need to do anything directly. You know, the aluminium industry, in all my years of working on aluminium and publishing 200 odd papers on the subject, I've almost never commented directly on my research, ever. And that is a very good strategy for them, because what they do is they allow all the users of their products to deal with this. And they give them their support. So the pharmaceutical industry uses huge amounts of aluminium. It's the pharmaceutical industry who defend the use of aluminium, not the aluminium industry.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And also, that, I mean, it sounds to me as if they've sort of, you know, isolated you. They've succeeded in, by not debating with you, they're saying, we're not going to engage with this guy. Let's just isolate him. Anyway, with Chris Busby, can you give us a bit of an insight, Chris? Because I know, as any individual that's taking on one of these lobbies, quite often the general public will simply not see the way that they effectively, you know, try and pin you down, put you in a corner or ignore you. So can you give us something from your experience, which is just a bit of an insight into how these lobbies work?
As far as the lobbies are concerned, I can't give you much of an insight into those. They pay, as far as I'm concerned, what they do is they pay a lot of people to attack me on the internet. In 2004, I was advising the Royal Society on the health effects of depleted uranium. At that time, there were a lot of people coming back from the wars in Iraq who were suffering from various kinds of cancer and a disease, a sort of DU-associated disease that nobody quite could characterize properly and so forth. So I was on this committee which went from 2001, 2004, that was funded by the Ministry of Defense. And during that time, I figured out that the problem was uranium particles, that the particles, when they get inside you, because they're nanoparticles, they have effects which are really quite, which are not predictable on the basis of the radiation risk model that exists. Okay. So I did a lot of work on that, and I had a student. I was given a visiting professorship at the University of Ulster, Northern Ireland, and I had a student there who worked on uranium particles, and we produced a lot of results which showed that these uranium particles are really extremely dangerous and caused all the cancers and all those effects. Okay. And at around about the same time, I did a study in Fallujah in Iraq, where we did an epidemiological study of the birth defects and so forth, and also cancers in Fallujah following the American use of depleted uranium in 2004. So I got three peer-reviewed papers out of that, and the first one of those went completely viral. And so I became a sort of expert on the health effects of depleted uranium. And then, but in 2011, when Fukushima happened, what happened was I was then attacked as some sort of mad scientist by George Monbiot on the front page of The Guardian. Okay. Now, up to that time, I had been funded by the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust. I mean, I was given a lot of money by those people in order just to sort of work. I mean, it wasn't for any particular purpose. It was in their category of really important people who might change the world sort of thing, you know. But after Monbiot, everybody ran for cover. You know, the Green Party dissociated itself from me. At that time, I was a science and technology speaker for the Green Party of England and Wales. I got kicked out of that. And the Joseph Rowntree people said, you know, ran for cover. They didn't want to be associated with somebody who was being attacked by important people and then they got into my Wikipedia entry that somebody had put up, and the whole, in fact, you can look at the internet even now and you can see all the attacks that take place on me, which basically I ignore, because if I were to spend my time fighting back, forget it. So my feeling is that if you're somebody that's dangerous, me, for an enormous organization with loads of money and sort of unbelievable power, which is the military and, you know, the nuclear military complex, who have to deal with uranium all the time. They use it as a weapon. It's part of their nuclear weaponry and all the rest of it. So I'm a very dangerous person. So I get attacked all over the place on the internet. The police bust into my house without any sort of warrant and look all over the place and throw me in jail as a bomb maker and all the rest of it. And then they have to let me go. But in fact, that actually did me a lot of good. So the thing is that people, that scientists that they don't like are categorized as conspiracy theorists. There are many, many areas where this is the case. You know, there's the mobile phone concerns, there's the vaccine concerns, there are people, and of course, in my case, people who believe that the radiation risk model is wrong, you know, and we all know, they say, and is published in the literature, like the Lancet and so forth, you know, that they know everything there is to know about radiation, and there's basically no problem because they understand it all, and nobody is dying near nuclear power stations, and the children with leukemia who die near the nuclear power stations die for some other reason, but they're not quite sure what it is, but anyway, it's certainly not radiation and so forth. My point is that when I was talking about Fallujah, because after I did all that work on Fallujah and my student at the University of Ulster discovered the reasons why the uranium particles were dangerous, what happened is that I got attacked by Monbiot in The Guardian. And then shortly after that, the University of Ulster kicked me out. They said, you have to retire now or we'll kick you out. They say, you can say that you retired on your own or else we're going to give you the boot. So, of course, I retired. Then I went to the University of Bremen. I was taken in there, you know, like some little orphan in the storm. And I worked in the science department of the University of Bremen until they changed the head of department, or, you know, perhaps it happened automatically, and the new head of department booted me out and so forth. You know, of course, I didn't need to be in any of these universities because all the work I do is on my own. And the money I earned after the Browntrees stopped funding me, I obtained from working as an expert witness in United States court cases relating to radiation. And this is another thing that scientists can do. They can go into court and they can win cases on radiation and cancer, which I did. So I've done over 40 of almost 50 cases on radiation cancer, most of which we've won. So there are things that you can do if you're independent. If you're in a university like Poor Exley, then you're stuffed because they can get you.
I mean, we're talking to two I would consider to be very eminent scientists. Can I ask you, first of all, Chris Exley, can you just give us some facts which you think are we're getting towards this whole situation of these things being taboo when there's no money to research these things and it's almost impossible to get them published and peer reviewed? Then we're starting to move into the area of the taboo. So can you just give us some a few nuggets of facts, things that you've discovered that you think that the lobbies and the establishment would rather we didn't know?
Well, yes. I mean, for the last couple of years, including writing in my recent book, I've said that there is a true pandemic that is ongoing in the world at the moment. And that pandemic is human exposure to aluminium. The last 2 years of our faux pandemic have, of course, helped very much to obscure that work. That work was heading towards some very strong conclusions before COVID, inverted commas, hit us. For example, you know, our most recent research, I would say, proved beyond doubt that aluminium plays a role in Alzheimer's disease. Not that aluminium is the only cause, but that it plays a role in the disease. And if you don't have aluminium in your brain, you will not get Alzheimer's disease in normal lifetime of an individual, let's say 100 years. Now, that is peer-reviewed science, published, very, very widely read, record numbers of downloads on the internet. So it is being read. It is being taken on board by many individuals. This is highly dangerous, because if a government suddenly said, well, hey, that Chris Exley is right, you know, this would not work well for any aspect of government. It would not, because our governments are completely and utterly dominated by the ambassadors for the aluminium industry and others. So anything that would implicate aluminium in a common human disease, and unfortunately, Alzheimer's is now a common human disease, you know, would be devastating for our economy. So, you know, I cannot be right, even though the science may, and I would say, says otherwise. So, you know, the most alarming thing to me is not simply that we have been able to pinpoint one particular condition, but it's understanding how aluminium pervades all aspects of human life. And if it is contributing to Alzheimer's, why is that the only thing it contributes to? Why would that be simply so specific that it is the only thing that aluminium contributes to? And the answer is it is not. In fact, we can be pretty confident that aluminium is contributing to 40 or 50 relatively common human diseases. And again, its burgeoning presence in ourselves, in humans, is only making this worse. And indeed, our use of aluminium is going up all the time. And our human exposure to aluminium is going up all the time. And this is a time bomb. I hope to live long enough to be able to say I told you so, but I guess I won't.
Well,
but
maybe help diffuse it a little bit, Chris. I mean, looking at the figures, I mean, Alzheimer's is pretty horrific. globally, there's something like 50 million people suffering with it. In the United States, I think it's 6 million, something like 2 million in the UK, or somewhere between 1 and 2 million. So one would have thought, with all these Alzheimer's charities out there, that, you know, they could funnel a few bob your way. Anyway, let's go to Dr. Chris Busby. Chris, I'm postulating here that there are now taboo areas where scientists are not literally must fear to tread. Quite clearly, we're talking to two scientists who do tread in those areas. But can you just give us what you think are some of these sort of taboo facts that we're being told that by the media and by the funders to steer well clear of and not to think about?
Yes. Well, of course, the main one at the moment is COVID and the vaccines. And in fact, there's some really horrifyingly bad epidemiology associated with the information we are being given. I've got a paper here that I've been looking at: COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths by vaccination status, produced by the Washington State Department of Health. Now, this was trumpeted by the New York Times about a week or so, you know, and what it basically says, simply, it says that, you know, the number of people who are vaccinated in hospitals are far less than the number of people who are unvaccinated in hospitals. Okay? And so we're supposed to reduce from that vaccination is much better than non-vaccination. It's a horrifying piece of epidemiology because it doesn't say anything about the actual social class or the color or any real information, even the age of the people who are in the hospitals, vaccinated and unvaccinated. And all of these epidemiologically are confounding issues relating to the conclusions that these people come to. But yet it gets on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post as evidence that we should all rush out and vaccinate ourselves, to say nothing about what might happen downstream and about what happens immediately after all the people who just fall down dead once they've been vaccinated. So that's the first thing, right? That's the main taboo area at the moment. In fact, it's so bad that if you try and say anything on Facebook or anywhere, you know, these social media platforms, you say anything about vaccination, you immediately get banned like that. So I've sort of been a little bit cautious about it all, but I can say it all here. That's one thing. The second thing, of course, is radiation. I mean, at the moment, Boris Johnson wants to turn England into a production factor for small nuclear reactors. And I've got a case on in Scotland for a guy who worked with these small nuclear reactors on a nuclear submarine, because that's what they power them with. Okay. And of course, they produce, because they're small and they leak like sieves, and the radiation levels around them are absolutely enormous, and all the stuff coming out of them gets into the bodies of the people. And these submarine people who work with nuclear reactors at sea are all dying like flies from all sorts of radiation-related diseases. So that's another one. You're not allowed to talk about the health effects of low-level radiation, or rather internal radiation. That's the second one. Third one, of course, is GM foods. Well, that's sort of that used to be a big deal. In fact, anybody who said GM foods were dodgy immediately lost their job and disappeared into hyperspace. You know, we see lots of cases of that. And vaccination itself. I mean, look at that poor guy who said that the vaccination caused autism. I mean, he was just utterly destroyed almost at the flick of a switch. Forget his name now. But actually,
you're talking about Dr. Andrew Wakefield here. Who,
that's right.
Actually,
that's right.
I mean, he was completely, had to leave the country, didn't he?
He was absolutely hacked to pieces, and quite wrongly too, because in fact, the evidence that he brought forward was perfectly reasonable evidence, and it actually had some sort of meaning. I mean, it may not have been 100%, but it was certainly enough under precautionary principle level, you know, to flag up a problem that people should properly have followed. But of course, they didn't. The problem in science, I can tell you, this is all, I've been doing this radiation stuff since 1990. And if somebody manages to get a paper published in the mere peer review literature that suggests there's some problem, immediately somebody else comes along and writes some bogus paper to show that is wrong. They have an entire operation going based in America, the University of Illinois Institute of Science and Technology. It's almost like a control room. You can be like in Churchillian control room where they're downstairs pushing pieces of paper over maps and saying, oh, look, this bastard Busby's now come out with a new theory and we've got to knock that on the head quickly and blah, blah, blah. It's absolutely the case, I can tell you. It's absolutely the case. What else? Global warming. There's a good one. I mean, people who come along and say that global warming might actually be a consequence of a superposition of a lot of different waves of heating due to different phenomena at the same time, some kind of Fourier transform excess risk. These people are not allowed any space. They're just shot down instantly. Okay, because we all now believe that global warming is caused by carbon dioxide produced by, you know, anthropogenic carbon dioxide. For myself, I've kept out of this, but you know, between us here on this program, I can tell you that I'm not at all convinced that global warming is caused by anthropogenic activity in carbon dioxide. It can't help.
I mean, there's definitely an attempt to say that climate change is man-made, and anyone that questions it is questioning the basic fundamentals of science, because it's already been proved.
The problem, Tony, is that science has become black boxed. Okay, in the old days, like if you go back to Lord Kelvin and those, you know, like in the good old days of science, where you went out and you did things yourself, Joule and all those people, you know, right at the beginning, that they were immediately associating the facts with a theory. Okay, but the problem is that those theories have moved forward in time, and they've been increasingly sort of accommodated in universities and turned into textbooks, and then the textbooks are read by younger people who then produce more textbooks, and all this stuff is moved forward to the point where you get a pick, for instance, in one area of mine, which is radiation biology, and in fact the way in which cells work themselves. I've written a book about this one, because I used to work for Burroughs Wellcome at the cell level, looking at molecular pharmacology using spectroscopic methods, and I had the idea that actually most of the stuff you see in cell biology is complete baloney. I mean, it's what you see is the product of graphic designers and illustrators, you know. So you see a picture of the cell with all these twiddly kind of colored things inside it with arrows and names and all the rest of it, but the real dynamic of the cell, the dynamic of life itself, is completely unknown. But it's been black boxed into all these kind of conceptual machines that are applied to any question, and the answer, you put the question into the machine and out comes the answer, but most of it's rubbish.
I mean it's interesting you mentioned Burroughs Wellcome, because they were headquartered, this is the Wellcome Trust, right next to my where I went to school, Eden Park in southeast London, and we used to joke about the cows with two heads next door.
Yes, yes. Well, I worked there.
That's interesting.
Langley Park.
And so I was through the fence, Chris, you know, as a teenager in the school there. And so that particular spot, I mean, it's now been completely redeveloped, turned into luxury flats in the big house, etc. Anyway, look, let's just move on to look at, you know, we've shown where things are going. And I'd just like you, Chris Exley, if you can look into your crystal ball. If things continue like this, where is science? What direction is science heading in?
Yeah, I think the three of us, we can pontificate as much as we like, and we can have a bit of a go at the establishment and all sorts. But we also have to provide the young people of today, the people who still want to be scientists, believe in science, believe they will be able to do good science and become great scientists. They have to have reasons. They have to have the support that they need. And, you know, I think everything we've talked about does not mean that science is dead. It just is an example of corruption. You know, it's the same as pollution of the environment is almost certainly why we have all the other issues, including climate change. Now, we are not talking. This is something that I fundamentally believe can be changed, because we have seen change. You know, I started my scientific career in 1984. So it's coming up to 40 years. That's a relatively short period of time. And if you go back 40 years before that, the changes in science have been absolutely monumental. So the changes in science can be monumental again. And we do not have to go in the direction that we appear to be going in, where everything is dictated to us, where, as Dr. Busby says, everything is coming out of a black box without any real explanation of what's going on. I think people like myself, like Dr. Busby, people who have been scholars of science for all of their careers, we know that science is and the way in which things were remains unknown. We know this, particularly in the world of biology, which is my world. We know that X-ray crystallography is not something specifically relevant to what is happening inside you and I. None of my proteins are solid structures. None of the mechanisms that have been derived from science of that sort are probably happening. But that's the way in which we've used different methods, different things that have become available, and they have provided us with an interpretation at that time. Those interpretations will change, science will continue, and, you know, we have to, maybe what will happen here is a process of natural selection, because at the moment, we have way too many so-called scientists. We have way too many people in academia. This is most of the people in academia have not any interest whatsoever in pure and fundamental science. They have no interest in being right or wrong. Their only interest is in going up the particular ladder that they are on. But there are always a group of people. There are always people coming through who believe otherwise. And perhaps we can have a process of natural selection whereby something happens within the environment. Maybe it's the emergence of true philanthropy. Perhaps that could catalyze things where individuals do get a chance to do what they wish to do, regardless of any economic value or other value. What we used to call a long time ago, blue sky research. Maybe that can begin to prosper. And you know, that can then be the next stage. That could be something that makes a change, even a change with respect to the way government funds science, etc. Maybe government will never fund any science in the future. It'll all come through a different way. But I don't want to leave this conversation to leave young people completely disheartened about science. No, get into science. Be absolutely determined and strong-willed and want to do it at all costs. And yes, it will be tough, but it will be so rewarding. I have had a wonderful life in science, and I wouldn't change it for anything. And I've met the most wonderful scientists and worked with the most wonderful scientists, and I wouldn't change any of that, despite what's happened to me in the last couple of years.
Well, maybe it's that, we grew up in some golden age, a little bit of a golden age anyway, after World War II, when there was a bit more freedom. But, I mean, if we go back to Copernicus, he was pilloried, wasn't he, for saying that the Earth might go round the sun. So there's really, in a way, nothing new about this. Anyway, Dr. Chris Busby, could you give us your perspective on if things carry on as they are, where we're heading here, with a sort of a false consensus in all these various scientific areas, and what may be the best way to do something about that, and how we can turn things around?
We've had in the last 20, 30 years, or maybe longer, maybe 50 years, a sort of Sovietization of science. So it's the thing has turned into a kind of religious movement almost. It's like it's got its priesthood and its acolytes and its catechism and its black boxes and all the rest of it.
Yes, and its heretics.
Yes, it's got its heretics. That's right. And the thing is that my message to the young people is this, is that if you want to do science, then don't go to the universities, right? I mean, after all, Einstein didn't go to the universities. And Einstein said to my friend Ernest Stoneglass, the late Ernest Stoneglass, who started all this radiation stuff off long ago, he went to see Einstein with some theory about protons that he had. I don't know if it was right or not. But he spent 3 days with Einstein, and he came back and he said to me, this is Stoneglass said to me, that Einstein told him not to go to uni. He said, if you want to do this physics, if you want to do fundamental research, stay away from the universities and just figure it out yourself. Now, nowadays, it's not so easy to do that because, you know, some of these machines that you need are extremely costly and all the rest of it. But actually, most of the stuff you need is in your head. And young people can do that. They can sit and if there is any hope for the future, that is it. But for myself, I think there is no hope for the future of science as it is practiced now. It has become a sort of, it's like Mary Midgley, the philosopher, said, science as religion. That's what it is now. It's science as religion.
Okay, but hang on. I mean, Chris, what do you think the pinch points are? Where do we need to be focusing on if we're going to change things?
the most important area that we have, the most important machine that we have, is the one that we are using now, Tony, where we can talk together on the internet and we can be independent and we can say what we like. And ultimately, I think people read what you say and they come to the conclusion that it's right or wrong on the basis of common sense. And a lot of these scientific papers that are published in The Lancet and the British Medical Journal and the literature generally, if you look at them, you think, no, this is a load of nonsense. This is a load of tendentious twaddle. So we can use the internet to promulgate our understanding of what's going on. And people on the internet, there are lots of very clever people on the internet. You can see that in the responses and the remarks that are written under all of the videos that are made about more or less anything.
Well, I noticed, for example, during the whole COVID business, as a website called ResearchGate, which has done incredibly well, where various virologists, epidemiologists, all sorts of people involved in this in a professional way have put their postulated various things and put forward their ideas. And then they found a fantastic amount of, for example, if it looks like this is something which does deserve looking into, for example, the use of ivermectin off message. Or whatever it is, the idea that you're not using it for what it was supposed to be, but it actually can be very effective for COVID. There was people piling on there. So online, it seems that these things can be sorted out. But look, that's no good, Dr. Busby, is it, when it comes to things like national policy? Because as we've seen, there's been some terrific mistakes in national policy as a result. And potentially, according to this is in COVID, according to Dr. Tess Laurie here in Bath, she reckons something like 60,000 people have lost their lives unnecessarily because of the failure and the blocking of the use of ivermectin.
Well, I have to say that the way in which state has approached this issue of the pandemic has been deeply suspicious of the way in which they've done all this stuff. There's so many clues that this has been controlled, by some for some other reason, and God knows what it is. But the way in which they behaved is A, stupid, and B, very worrying, to put it very mildly. Anyway, I haven't taken any vaccine and I don't intend to. Okay. And my boss, who is a billionaire, okay, he took all the vaccines. He said, oh, hey, Chris, you got to take the vaccines or else you'll die and all this stuff. Anyway, he got seriously ill. So he got a breakthrough infection after three vaccines in Paris. And he was in hospital for 3 weeks in a coma on ventilators and goodness knows what. So I don't think taking the vaccine is necessarily a great idea myself, and I'm keeping away from it. Never mind about the downstream effects. God only knows what those are. But even the immediate effects are not so great.
I think it's important that we should not take the government narrative as science. Right from the very beginning, from March 2020, I turned off the BBC, I turned off all mainstream media, I turned off my radio. This was not science. And what is happening now, and I don't know why it's happening, is it being allowed to happen or is it because people are becoming braver? I am not sure. But what is happening now is that more and more actual science is being published on this subject, which is showing that the government narrative here, abroad, across the world, has been entirely and utterly wrong. And as Chris Busby says, we're not sure why they've decided to do that, and there may well be some dark and terrible reason for it, but it's not about science. When the science is done well and is put out for review, even if it's not official peer review. You've mentioned ResearchGate. ResearchGate has proven to be, as you've said, a great place for good scientists and bad scientists to get their ideas across without going through the process of peer review, with the view often that if it's well accepted on ResearchGate, they will then write it up for peer review elsewhere. But it is working like that. And I think, I am an optimist. And I do believe that you can't corrupt science. You can only corrupt the process of doing it and the people doing it. And it will come out. It will be shown, for example, either that Chris Exley's a complete nutcase where aluminium is concerned, or that Chris Exley, having spent his entire life looking at this one subject, was partially right. And if I'm partially right, the science will show that at some point it might take 100 years. We might actually, human race might have died off before that. You know, we are looking at those sorts of scenarios. So, you know, I'm a massive optimist where science shines through. I mean, no one is more disappointed. So, for example, I am Kiel's only university research fellow. It's a very difficult position to get. It's a 10-year fellowship. I had it from 2004 up to 2002, an eight-year fellowship. Only one person from Kiel has ever got that. So the Royal Society has been my bastion of great science. But what happened during COVID? Nothing, absolutely nothing. They said nothing. They contributed nothing. They shut up. Why did they shut up? Because the vast majority of their funding comes from government. This is so disappointing to someone like me to see these great, you know, as I say, monuments of science and world science, not just British science, going quiet, you know, at the convenient time. But it will change because the science will come out. People will do it. And there will be no choice then. The consensus will change slowly but surely.
Okay, just to wrap up, Dr. Chris Busby, do you want to share with us your thoughts about, I mean, we've already talked a little bit about how young people can get into this, but what areas of science you think can be valuable into the future? And how you tell whether you're setting off on a scientific career which is simply, I mean, a little bit like a journalistic career, which is just saying and doing what you're supposed to because it's a prestigious and well-paid career, rather than something which is actually going to make a difference and to do a bit of, you know, true cutting-edge research, which is going to kind of break a consensus and potentially take mankind on. Because I find it absolutely amazing that, you know, and it's probably one of the reasons why China is so successful economically, that the Chinese are publishing a lot of this stuff. And they're quite prepared to look to believe that maybe the consensus needs to be broken and that some new ideas might be out there, that China is doing this. Because it seems to me we need to be, you know, concentrating to a certain extent on the publishing side of all this to make sure that those voices are heard. Anyway, what's your message for the youngsters?
Is don't believe anything. That's where you start, okay? You start by not believing anything you're told and looking for yourself and figuring out for yourself whether you think it's right or wrong and what's needed to be done to see whether it's right or wrong. And the areas, the two areas, the most important areas, in my opinion, for young scientists at the moment, firstly, is epidemiology. We're on spaceship Earth flying through the void, you know, and basically destroying everything that we've got, using everything up and crapping all over the place with just about every toxin that you can imagine. And yet there's no dial on the spaceship Earth that says danger. Okay. If there were such a dial, it would be an epidemiological dial. If you want to know what's going on, you study the people. You don't go back to the beginning and try and figure out from first principles whether these materials will kill people. You look to see if the people who are exposed to them are suffering relative to people who are not exposed to them. This is what science is. This is fundamental method of science. John Stuart Mill's canons. So you start with epidemiology. That's what we want to know. We should have a universal epidemiological system that looks at people who live in different areas who are exposed to different things and comparing their health status. That's the first thing. The second thing is that, in my opinion, the understanding of life itself has gone badly astray. The way that, like I was saying earlier on, that the dynamic of life, what actually goes on in the cell, we do not know. We have frozen electron microscope pictures of what's inside the cell that are stained with all sorts of materials that reflect electrons. And so we can, if you like, look inside the transistor radio set and we can see all the little colored things in there, the resistors and the transistors and the capacitors and all that. And we can call them names, but we really don't know what's going on. We don't know how they work. And so people, if they want to, this is the most important area now, is to go into cell biology and try and figure out how life works from first principles. My own opinion, which I developed after working in Burroughs Wellcome on this and on drug design and all the rest of it, is that they are badly wrong, that the current picture of biology is completely nonsensical. And so the young people should, or those who want to, and I tried to get my children to do that at Cambridge too. My children went to Cambridge, but of course they weren't interested in doing that. They went and did something else.
Look, Chris, I've got to pull you up on that, because what is it that you think is so wrong about what we currently understand with cell biology?
I don't think it operates on the level of chemistry, actually. I think it operates on the level of physics. So I think that interchanges inside cells occur as a result of communication between molecules at infrared frequencies. I've written a book about this, and I'm doing work here, research on it, to show that it's true, that molecules detect other molecules that are like themselves through resonance. And if you take the temperature of the universe, the temperature of the universe is such that the molecular emission spectra for living systems, which you can say are between about 300 and 320 Kelvin, are in the infrared. So I, and incidentally, there's some research that shows this by a chap called Luca Turin, who was working at Imperial College, no, University College, in the 90s, and he was looking at why people smell this smell and that smell and the other smell, and what's the basis of smell. Anyway, they kicked him out because they thought he was a nutcase. So he's now working for the perfume industry, doing rather well. But he showed by various really clever, sophisticated experiments that the sensation of smell was modulated not by chemical structure, but by infrared emission spectra.
That's definitely some food for thought. And it's lovely to discover that you may have been working through the other side of the at Burroughs Wellcome when I was at Langley Park School, just over the road. Amazing stuff, really. So anyway, Chris Exley, what are your thoughts for the future? Where do you think are fruitful areas for young people to be looking at the moment?
Yeah, well, I'm going to sort of add a little bit on to what Dr. Busby is saying, because I am a great believer in Darwin's theory of natural selection. And I actually believe that almost everything is possible to be explained using natural selection, including physics. In other words, the cell is everything. It's physics, chemistry, and biology. But within there are what I call competitive equilibria, competing equilibria. And the way in which those particular equilibria eventually come to some sort of fruition is the signal, is the message that takes place. But everything is part of that. And, the concepts of survival of the fittest, of course, has got nothing to do with how strong you are. It's which compartment is the most appropriate and reaction is most appropriate in that compartment at that particular period of time. So I would really encourage even aspiring young cell biologists to think about things from the point of Darwinian natural selection, one of my great heroes in science.
Another thing I'll just add is I was always a bit mystified as what Burroughs was. I mean, we all know what the Wellcome Trust is next door, Chris. Sorry to obsess a bit about this, but I found out recently reading one of Victor Ostrovsky's books that Burroughs were the computer company that were producing the very first ever computers that would follow activists around by using bugs and things like that, where you could see where your opposition was, and you could actually watch them on a screen coming together for a meeting so that you could then go and spy on that meeting. So that's what they were doing with the Mossad back in the 1970s and 1980s, Burroughs being linked to the Wellcome Trust. Anyway, look, Dr. Chris Busby and Dr. Chris Exley, thanks ever so much for joining us. I think it's a fascinating discussion. If you could just both give your websites briefly and we can round up there. Chris Busby is first.
Well, most of my stuff I put on Green Audit, www.greenaudit.org. But a lot of the radiation stuff I do is on the Low Level Radiation Campaign website, which is llrc.org, Low Level Radiation Campaign. But most of my stuff's on the Green Audit website. But recently I've been putting all my stuff on Academia and on ResearchGate because it gets around.
Okay. And Chris Exley?
So ours is aluminiumresearchgroup.com, all one word, aluminiumresearchgroup.com.
Well, Dr. Chris Busby and Dr. Chris Exley, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.